The Friday before I left Palestine, there was a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv, and four Israelis were killed outside of a nightclub. And this is something we've seen before in Israel, and it's tragic and it's horrible. It was the Friday before I was going to leave. It was, you know, just this past Friday, and I was sitting in a hostel in East Jerusalem having conversations with other Palestinians about it. And there was just kind of like a feeling of depression and of regret and sorrow across the board, because Palestinians, just as well as the rest of the world, see these attacks as a horrible thing. And I think what kind of like really made this one particularly bad for a lot of Palestinians is that as soon as the news came in that this had happened, people knew right away that these so-called peace talks that people have been talking about for the last 3 weeks, which I'm going to actually focus a lot on, these meager gains that had been made at the Sharm el-Sheikh summit on February the 8th were all going to be reversed. It was like it was all for nothing. And of course, the next day, Israel announced that they were cutting off ties with the Palestinian Authority, and they were going to be pulling out of 5 Palestinian cities, but of course they reversed that as well. And what we're seeing is the occupation the same as it had been all along. When I was on the plane ride back, I was reading an op-ed or an editorial in Haaretz, which is one of the leading kind of liberal newspapers in Israel. It's written by Thomas L. Friedman. I just wanted to read one quick little paragraph from this. He's talking about Middle East tipping points, so events that happen in the Middle East that kind of shift the political framework or what's happening at the time. He writes, and he's talking about the suicide bombing. Indeed, the Middle East playground, as Friday's suicide bomb in Israel reminds us, the tipping points are sometimes more like teeter-totters. One moment you're riding high, and the next minute you're slammed to the ground. And I just looked at this, and I mean, I had to laugh. I was on a plane ride coming back from Palestine, and I thought to myself, riding high? Were we riding high? There was no peace. I mean, it boggles my mind that I've spent the last 2 months in Palestine, and the whole international community has been talking about peace, and there's no fucking peace there. It's the same that you've been reading about all along, and it's a really disturbing thing, because I think we're being fed these stories which simply aren't true. I mean, there's talks, yes, I mean, Abu Mazen was elected on January the 9th, and yes, he did meet with Sharon, and yes, they are, you know, announcing these very lofty things, but you go and you work on the ground, and you see the confiscation of lands, and you see people still being treated like animals, and widespread human rights abuses, and you think, what has changed? What do these talks mean? I want to talk about three things specifically that were big issues in the 2 months I was in Palestine that kind of underlie this idea of peace and how there really isn't a real just peace in Palestine. One is the issue of East Jerusalem, where I observed the elections from on January the 9th. The other is the settlements that exist all throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, although they will be leaving the Gaza Strip soon. And the wall as well, this infamous, you know, they called it on our birthright trip, the anti-terror fence. I cannot look at this fence, wall, whatever you want to call it, ever again and think of it anything other than a symbol of apartheid. Okay, going back to East Jerusalem. I was there in East Jerusalem at the time of the elections. And it was a really disturbing thing because just to, like, okay, on the one hand, read these news reports about this democracy that was coming to the Middle East and these elections, but then also to see, like, to kind of get this feeling of pessimism on the ground in East Jerusalem of, you know, how little things could potentially change after the outcome of the elections. Out of a total 120,000 eligible Palestinian voters living in East Jerusalem, only 5,000 of them were permitted to vote by the State of Israel. Well, this man turned up at this Israeli post office, which was just inside the Jaffa Gate in Jerusalem. This man had been living in Jerusalem his whole life. He's walking out of the post office here, and he was denied his vote there. They wouldn't let him vote. At the end of the day, 4 people were allowed to vote in this post office. 4 people out of a steady stream of people that were coming in and out. John Kerry visited this post office in the middle of the day, and you know, there's a lot of like flash and hoopla, and oh, it's John Kerry, he's so good looking, and like he didn't say anything. I mean, this wasn't something that came up, but just, I mean, this idea of like you show up in your neighborhood where you've been living your whole life, and you're not allowed to vote because the state under which you're voting is, you know, exerting this claim. And I think it was very clear what Israel was trying to do with only permitting 5,000 people to vote, is that, you know, Abu Mazen was elected, and he was the most favored candidate by Israel, and he was the most favored candidate by the West. And all of a sudden, there's a lot more talk about this oncoming Palestinian state, which has always claimed it wants East Jerusalem as its capital. I think this is a very threatening thing for the Israelis, who also, you know, exert their sovereignty over Jerusalem. They annexed East Jerusalem after the war of 1967. So there was just, again, like a widespread denial of like basic political rights. Also, in the communities around East Jerusalem, we're seeing something really disturbing right now. Again, as we move supposedly closer to this, you know, oncoming Palestinian state in whatever kind of horrible form that's going to exist in, you know, being a Palestinian state cut up throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This photo actually right here was taken in a village called Walaja, which is just about 5 kilometers to the south of Jerusalem. And just to see the amount of land confiscations happening right now around Jerusalem, in places like Walaja, and there's another neighborhood of East Jerusalem called Al-Muntar, which the Israelis have put demolition orders on pretty much every single home in this village. You know, it's like this rush to completely crush any kind of sign of Palestinian life in this area. Walaja was a very small village. It had about 1,000 people living there, and the morning we went to visit it, we went because there were Israeli demolition vehicles in the village. 56 homes had demolition orders on them. And the feeling in the village is because the Israelis now want to complete the wall around the city. And of course, any home that falls within the buffer zone of the wall, being, I think it's 100 meters in a lot of areas, their homes get torn down. Again, this is after the elections, mind you, and this is while people are talking about peace. Okay, the settlements I wanted to talk a bit about, because a lot of the work that I was doing in Palestine was in the city of Hebron. For those of you who might have not ever heard of Hebron, it's one of the bigger Palestinian cities. It's about 150,000 people in the south of the West Bank. And it's kind of a unique situation because they have the extreme privilege of having a 24-hour nonstop military presence in the city, whereas in places like Ramallah and Nablus, you know, the army will come in for a few hours, shoot people, and leave. In Hebron, they're there to stay. And why? It's because Hebron, being the 4th holiest city to the Jewish people, the Israelis have gone in and built 5 settlements directly within the city of Hebron. So there's 600 Israelis living within Hebron itself, another 6,000 living in the settlement of Kiryat Arba, which is just to the east of Hebron. The really scary thing about the Hebron settlers is, whereas you may have settlers in other parts of Palestine, in places like Ariel or Gush Etzion, who are economic settlers, meaning that the state of Israel gives incredible financial incentives for people to move to the settlements. So, you know, poor people are very attracted to them, and you can't blame them, because if the state is, you know, giving you a set of keys and some money to move to a place, like, you're probably going to take that. But the difference in Hebron is that the settlers are kind of driven by this fanatical religious fundamentalism of exerting some kind of religious entitlement to the city. So what you see is just sheer racism throughout the city, kind of like KKK style. It's really disturbing. Like, you walk around the old city in Hebron. Hebron's very old. It's thousands of years old. And there's just graffiti everywhere in Hebrew. Arabs out. Die, Arabs. Suck my cock, Arabs. You know, Stars of David everywhere. And it's like this imagery that's really killing the city in such a depressing way. But maybe to shift the focus to the Gaza disengagement, I think that's an interesting thing because Sharon and Israel are really getting a big pat on the back for this right now. The Gaza disengagement has been set for July of this year. So the 8,000 settlers who are in Gaza are going to leave. You know, there's all these huge calls to action on the part of these settlers in Gaza about doing like kind of mass civil disobedience. And I was actually laughing about that too, because they're kind of using the same terminology that we'd use in the ISM, like sit-ins against the army and, you know, resist and civil disobedience. But, you know, they're asserting their right to live on stolen land illegally, which I think is kind of a big important difference there. So the way Sharon has put this disengagement, you know, he kind of said in this very like teary-eyed way at a press conference that this is the hardest decision I've ever had to make. And, you know, it's like, you know, he's very emotional about it. And what we're actually seeing as a result of the Gaza disengagement is an upping of the scale and the intensity of settlement expansion in the West Bank. A lot of people kind of perceive of this as Sharon's payback for losing Gaza. I mean, the Likud party throughout their existence has been very vocal about their support for the policy of settling in Palestine. So for them to lose Gaza, I think it's you know, on a political level, it's very damaging and very hard for them. So as a result, we're seeing the root of the wall shifting so that it's gonna enclose some of the major settlements in the West Bank, like Ariel, like Gush Etzion. And the settlements, I mean, the impact on Palestinian life is almost indescribable. I don't even know where to start, because it's disgusting. I mean, you look at these neighborhoods and they really look kind of like, they look alien in a sense, because first of all, like on a physical level, Arab homes, they have flat roofs, right? And then with Israeli homes, they all have like pointed roofs. And these settlements look a lot like the kind of suburbia that we would know, you know, just uniform houses in rows, usually built on hilltops because it's a strategic position. You know, the settlers are armed to the teeth and very, very threatened by the fact that they have indigenous Palestinian neighbors. They have a tendency to kind of shoot anyone that will get close to the settlements. And they're really horribly affecting a lot of places in the West Bank that I went to. Tawani is a small village, again, to the south of Hebron. It's a village that's 500 years old. It has 250 people living there. And it has the unfortunate fact that it's the people of Tawani live very close to an Israeli settlement called Ma'on. The settlers of Ma'on have been attacking not only school children, farmers, any locals in the village of Tawani for the last 20 years of its existence, but recently they've started attacking international activists who've come there to support the people of Tawani. A few days before these pictures were taken, two Italians from a group, Operation Dove, were beaten to the point of hospitalization by settlers wearing black masks with baseball bats and chains. And what we'd like to tell ourselves is that, yeah, these settlers are crazy and they just represent a lunatic fringe group, and, you know, liberal, rational Israelis do not support them, which actually is true. For the most part, a widespread support of settlement disengagement in, you know, mainstream Israeli society. But the scary thing is that the government and state policy in Israel acts completely in line with these crazed settlers. So when we were out in Tawani, this is a demonstration where we simply accompanied shepherds to their fields to graze because, you know, for the last few weeks, the shepherds were being attacked by the settlers. What does the army do? The army comes in, says that all of the fields are a closed military zone, and forces the shepherds off their land. So essentially what they were doing was the same work that the settlers had been doing. There was no difference there. And we had this one really interesting discussion with a soldier during this demonstration. We were talking about this one really notorious settler in the area. His name was Dove, and I think it was in 2001, Dove got into a fight with two Palestinian shepherds. Now, for years before that, this guy Dove, who lived in Maon, had just had this horrible reputation of nonstop harassment of shepherds and the people of At-Tuani. Now, this one morning he gets into a fight with two Palestinian shepherds. He shoots one of the shepherds in the leg. The other shepherd fights back, takes the gun off of him, and killed Dove. So when the soldiers were out in the field on this one morning we were there, we were asking them why we had to leave the field, and one of them said, well, you know, there's very dangerous people living in the village of At-Tuani. Did you know that one of them killed a man named Dove? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, everyone in the village of Tuani knows about Dove. And I tried to tell the story of what Dove had done and why he had been killed. And what the soldier said to me was, oh, no, we love Dove. Yeah, he does our work for us. And I thought that was a really interesting thing because, yes, the settlers do the work of the army, and the army does the work of the settlers. And there's really kind of like it blurs the line there. And I think it's quite clear that there really won't be any peace in Palestine until all of the settlements are gone and the land is given back. I'll just kind of like wrap up by talking a little bit about the wall. It was interesting because just a few weeks ago, in the Knesset, the Israelis have approved the final route of the infamous illegal by international law wall. And on the Birthright tour, we're actually brought on a tour of the anti-terror fence. And I think it's really interesting that they use that kind of vocabulary because in a way, it's really fundamentally racist. If you're talking about this wall in a sense of it being, you know, a security justification, and when you look at the same time, if you really, really look at the people that this wall is affecting, you can't in any way believe that it's being put there for Israel's security. If it is being put there for Israel's security, why is it being built, you know, 10, 20, 30 kilometers into the West Bank on Palestinian territory? Why is it being built, you know, in this very clear way, like around all the illegal settlements? So it's having such a detrimental effect on people's lives, and it has been since they started constructing it in 2003. The interesting thing is, okay, so they approved this new route for the wall, and so now it's only going to annex 7% of Palestinian land as opposed to 16% before. And again, we're supposed to, like, you know, oh, breathe a sigh of relief because, you know, these benevolent Israeli politicians are really kind of like getting off our backs in a way. The scary thing, though, is that, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's 7%, doesn't matter if it's 16%, doesn't matter if it's like 0.001%. The fact is that they're stealing Palestinian land. And Sharon is making it very clear that this wall is going to demarcate the future borders for this Palestinian state. So again, like if we go back to what I was talking about East Jerusalem before, you can kind of see this pattern of like, okay, the elections happened, this Palestinian state is coming on, we got to rush and do something because these Palestinians are getting uppity, they're going to start demanding their rights, they're going to have a state, and we got to really assert Israel as being here and there, and Palestine as being there. So these are the kind of effects that the wall is having. Very soon after the final route was announced, the construction of the wall really sped up. This photo here was taken in a village called Bilin, which is close to Bidu, which is not far from Ramallah. It's in the West Ramallah area. It was really scary because we went to Bilin 3 or 4 days in a row. Each day was like we would have these nonviolent demonstrations, and they'd be met with the same brutal military violence. army soldiers shooting tear gas canisters directly at people's bodies, rubber bullets, wooden bats, just punching old people in the face, hitting women. It's disturbing to see what's happening to these people and also to see what's happening to their land. I mean, sure, it's one thing that people are being beaten up and that's horrible, but I think all too often we don't recognize the violence that's being done unto the land as another form of illegitimate violence. Again, like if you're out in a field and if you're standing with a farmer and if he's watching his olive trees being torn up, which is what we are seeing on this day, these photos were taken, that's violence. You're cutting him off from his livelihood. And this man isn't a terrorist. And this wall is being built supposedly in the name of anti-terror interests. And it becomes very clear that the wall is itself terrorism. Again, the intensity here of the people confronting the army, knowing that if they don't confront them on this day, and if they don't keep going back out into these fields to have these demonstrations day in, day out, this wall is going to be built. They're going to be cut off from their farmlands, and then it's going to be too late, and Israel will have annexed the territory. Bilin is 10 kilometers into the Green Line. And this resistance wasn't just happening in Bilin. I mean, over these few days, it really started to pick up in the Salfit area, which is in the kind of the center of the West Bank, in Bidu, in East Jerusalem, in Al-Ram. So it was kind of happening all over the place. And it's just really neat to see how these demonstrations kind of exploded over the course of a week after this decision in the Knesset had been made. And you can see here, I mean, this is how people fight back. They're forced to fight back, and it's a very legitimate fight back, but with simple things like rocks and slingshots against the most powerful army in the world. And I think in a way, it serves as an inspiration. Not just the rock throwing, but everything. I mean, the demonstrations by students out in the fields, the demonstrations by farmers, people's just everyday refusal to accept what is happening in their homes. And it's really important to kind of like put the emphasis on that. I guess I'll just kind of wrap up by saying that in a way I lost a lot of hope being in Palestine to see that the world was talking about a peace that wasn't there, and to kind of see in the faces of the Palestinian people how they're just being sold out all over again. I think it re-emphasizes for us that there can really be no peace in the area without justice, because we just enter into these endless summits and talks, and it just goes on in circles. I mean, I'm also at a loss to conclude, because I think in a way, too, it's very important to look at the inspirational side of the Palestinian resistance, the fact that people are fighting so hard for their lives, that it's incredible. And now, given this context that there's supposedly peace in the area, I think that we have kind of a duty to inform ourselves and to kind of see past this media haze and to look at what's happening on the ground and to support this resistance any way we can.